My lecture today is on the life and ministry of Susanna Wesley. I've chosen my words somewhat advisedly. Susanna Wesley was not a minister as we normally use that word, of course, but hers was a ministry every bit as much as those given to her sons, to George Whitefield, to the Apostle Paul, no less. She was a truly great woman who exercised her God-given gifts for the ministry of the saints. She's known to history, of course, as the mother of John and Charles Wesley, who, along with George Whitefield, were co-founders of Methodism. But she is more than this, a woman of rare gifts. She displayed an unlimited patience and an iron self-discipline that deserved the respect and imitation of God's people in every age. Every woman here would do well to sit at her feet and learn, and no man would be worse off for doing so either. I'll begin with a brief sketch of her life and then view her in her roles as wife and mother. Susanna Wesley was born, really Susanna Ainslie. Susanna was born 1669 in London to Dr. and Mrs. Samuel Ainslie. She was the 25th child born to that long and happy union. Her father was a Puritan preacher and a man of God supreme. In the age of John Owen, Richard Baxter, and Thomas Manton, nobody was more admired than Samuel Ainslie. From him, Susanna inherited her good looks, charming manners, excellent mind, and a very strong personality. At the age of 13, she asserted the latter, quitting her father's church, I'm sorry to say, for the Church of England. 6 years later, now age 19, she married the Reverend Samuel Wesley, a fellow dissenter who had turned Episcopalian. In some ways, Mr. Wesley was an admirable man, a fine scholar and poet. He preached well and maintained church discipline with great rigor. But in other ways, the good pastor was less commendable. His was a domineering personality. He often boasted of being a king in the home, and so he was, absolute and arbitrary in his rule. One daughter appealed to him in these words, "Oh, sir, you are a good man, but you are seldom kind and rarely just. You are a tyrant to those who love you." And so he was. So he was a very hard man to live with because of his extremely domineering kind of personality. And of course, this kind of personality is always caused by arrogance. We have to criticize him for his pride as well. As far as we know, he never admitted his faults or apologized to any member of his family. And when you consider some of the things he did, this omission is positively scandalous. Once his wife Susanna did not say amen to one of his prayers, which she thought was mistaken. For this gross insubordination, as he thought, he left her for more than a year and swore he would never return, and did his level best to get a naval commission so that he would never return to England again. When this fell through, he moved home without so much as saying, "Hello, dear. By the way, I'm sorry for saying that." A very arrogant and hard man. Such a man, as you'd expect, was also easily offended and not anxious to forgive. There was once a fine young man in his parish who wanted to court his daughter, Hetty. She was then 28 years old, wanted to get married, and strongly attracted to this handsome and intelligent suitor. But because the young man had once sung a song that Wesley thought was disrespectful, he prohibited any contact between the young lovers. Later, when the same daughter became pregnant out of wedlock by another man, the good preacher forced her into an unwanted marriage, refused to attend the wedding, and vowed to never see her again. But if these character flaws were not enough, Samuel Wesley was also irresponsible with his money. As the rector of Epworth, he received a fine salary of about £200 per year. This was, maybe by today's standards, $100,000, $150,000. It was a lot of money. was roughly four times that which was paid to a dissenting minister like his own father or like the Reverend Mr. Ainslie. It wouldn't make him a rich man, to be sure, but it would provide a comfortable living to himself and his family if Wesley would only take care of his money. But he would not. Some of his fault was excusable. For example, he tried to supplement his income with farming and animal husbandry. But of course, the minister lacked experience in these fields and ended up losing money. He also hoped to make a fortune by riding. But here too, his impracticality would undo him. Wesley thought that he could make money by writing a commentary. Now that's probably a dubious thought itself, although it is possible. But instead of choosing to write on John or Romans or one of the other best-known works, he chose to write on one of the Bible's most obscure books, Job, to write a multi-volume set on Job, too expensive, and to author the great work in Latin. Needless to say, the Reverend Mr. Wesley's book was not a runaway bestseller. In fact, he worked more than 25 years on it and died before it was completed. And so there's some things about the man which could be excused insofar as his financial irresponsibility was concerned. But other defects are less easily excused. Remember, Wesley had a fine income, but also a large family and had to be a little careful with his money. Yet despite this fact, Wesley would spend several weeks per year in London, lodging in its finest hotels, drinking its best spirits, and faring sumptuously every day. And this he did without thought for his wife and children, who were often on the verge of starvation. Now it's true that he had church business to attend, that churchmen were expected to live well, and that he might gain promotion by associating with London's upper crust, but still his behavior and extravagant spending can never be justified. The poverty that this man suffered was self-induced and eminently deserved. Unfortunately, his family shared in it too. Now, what kind of wife would you expect such a man to have? Maybe an ex-wife? No, Susanna remained loyal to her heartless mate. But she was more than loyal in the sense of not divorcing him. Mrs. Wesley remained positively devoted to this scoundrel. She served him with contentment and joy, performing all wifely duties and doing them with pleasure. In one of his rare tender moments, Wesley wrote a poem describing his home life. She graced my humble roof and blessed my life, blessed me by a far greater name than wife, yet still I bore an undisputed sway, nor was it her task but pleasure to obey. It's hard enough for a wife to obey a good and kind man. It must have been nothing short of a crucifixion to obey a man as hard and arrogant and unbending as Samuel Wesley. Yet she did it, and according to his verse, it was not her task, but pleasure to obey. She also respected the man, as incredible as that may sound. When Wesley abandoned his wife, she and her children were penniless. And so, to avoid starvation, she wrote to a friend asking for money and explaining why she needed it. But although her letter is a model of understatement, she worried that her friend would expose her husband's evil deed. And so she wrote to her generous friend a second time with these words, "I humbly beg that the gentleman would be careful that the world may know nothing which may reflect on my master, but that the business may be concealed." In other words, although her husband had left her, sworn to never return, left her and several children penniless and on the verge of starvation, the thing that most worried her was that her husband's reputation might suffer. The man who had ruined her life must not be humiliated in public. What a stinging rebuke she is to the wives who take such pleasure in describing their husband's misdeeds. So she respected him, and also she loved him. The man's folly once landed him in debtor's prison, a stay, incidentally, that he wrote in a letter which he preferred to being at home with his family. But rather than letting the rascal suffer for his sins, Susanna offered to obtain his release by selling her only prized possessions, her wedding rings. But more than obeying, respecting, and loving her husband, Susanna Wesley suffered him without complaint. Oh, what she might have called him: a cruel tyrant, an incurable deadbeat, a thoughtless husband, an ugly father, an unsaved pastor, and many other things she might have called Mr. Wesley. But you'll search her writings in vain for such things. And this is how it should be, isn't it? Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Or to change the scripture, love covers a multitude of sins. She suffered him. She endured his cruelty, his heartlessness, his selfishness, his extravagant spending, and all of these things without so much as opening her mouth in protest. This gift of suffering quietly with grace has been all but lost in the modern world. It is thought to be wrong and positively harmful. I know a woman who blames her divorce on not fighting her husband enough, not arguing enough, not standing up enough, not giving him a piece of her mind enough. Susanna Wesley, though, bore her husband's evil ways with the dignity and grace that becomes a Christian woman. And she was not the loser for it. She had her reward both in this life and in the life to come. In this life, she received a clear conscience and the respect of all good people. Mr. Wesley was a very smart man, as I mentioned earlier, and also highly ambitious. And so it seemed likely that as an ambitious and very smart and man with real administrative abilities, that he would advance in the Church of England. But when news seeped out as to what he had done to his wife and the way he treated his children, he stayed put. They put him in the small rector of Epworth, and there he stayed for many years because everybody in England knew that Samuel Wesley was a devil. But everyone also knew that Susanna Wesley was a woman of extraordinary qualities. She had the respect of all good people. She has her reward in death, too. Many books have been written on the Wesley family, and all of them recognize her spiritual greatness. This is how it must be. Favor is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. And she has a reward in the resurrection, too. She continued in faith, love, sobriety, and holiness, and so we have no question that she will be saved. And so this is the sort of wife Susanna Wesley was, a wife worthy of your imitation, dear ladies. But Mrs. Wesley's true greatness was not so much as a wife, but as a mother. She bore 19 children in the same number of years, 10 of whom died. Her son John was one of the leading preachers of his day, perhaps second only to his friend George Whitefield. Another son, Charles, was also an excellent preacher and composed about 9,000 poems and hymns, including the immortal, "And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Savior's blood? Died he for me who caused his pain, for me who him to death pursued? Amazing love, how can it be that thou, my God, shouldest die for me?" That's Wesley's composition. 9,000 poems, most of which were hymns. The real founder of Methodist hymnody, and really one of the leading Protestant hymn writers ever. And her other children, though less known, of course, grew up to be fine and useful men and women. Hetty, the fallen daughter that I mentioned earlier, was converted and later became one of the Methodist's most prized female workers. These are women who spoke privately to other women concerning the needs of their soul. An older son, Samuel, also went into the ministry, and good things could be said of the others too. Thus, Susanna Wesley was an excellent mother and under less than easy conditions. The Lord said that wisdom is justified by her children. If we look at the children born to the union of Samuel and Susanna Wesley, and we recognize the kind of man Samuel was, we also see that Mrs. Wesley was justified in her children. Happily for us, though, she committed her ways to paper. Thus, more than 200 years after the good mother's death, she, being dead, yet speaks. From this point on, most of what I'm going to say today are the very words of Susanna Wesley herself. She gives advice to younger women on how to bring up their children, and the advice that she gives is really a combination of, really comes from a combination of Bible study and practical experience. So I think I have 11 different points that she gave. Now the titles for each point will be my own, but the substance of what I say about them comes from Mrs. Wesley. How do you bring up your children in a good way? Number one, start with the attitude. Start with the attitude. Here's what Mrs. Wesley says. In order to form the minds of children, the first thing to be done is to conquer their will and to bring them to an obedient temper. Now this term, obedient temper, is an old-fashioned word that means attitude. What Mrs. Wesley is saying is something like this. If you can control the child's attitude, you won't have to worry so much about his conduct. Now, many otherwise good parents fail here. They correct every misdeed, and they never enjoy a moment's rest. Why? Because the bad behavior is a result of an underlying bad attitude. Correct the attitude, and the behavior will largely take care of itself. Or in the words of Christ, make the tree good, and the fruit will be good. And so, in trying to reach our children, we don't slap their hands and straighten them out physically so much as we try to reach their attitudes. Start with the attitude if you want to have any success in the rearing of your children. Solomon put it this way, my son, give me your heart. Number two, start your discipline early. Start your discipline early. Again, Mrs. Wesley. Whenever the child is corrected, it must be conquered. And this will be no hard matter to do if it be not grown headstrong by too much indulgence. I call cruel parents who permit their children to get habits which they know must afterward be broken. Nay, some are so stupidly fond as in sport to teach their children to do things which in a while after they have severely beaten them for doing. And here she means bad habits are hard to break. And so work on your children's habits from the very beginning. If you give them a 4 or 5 year head start, it's no wonder you have so much trouble breaking their habits when they reach the teenage years. Start your discipline early. The father who chastens his son betimes, says the Bible. Then number three, attack selfishness in the child. Attack selfishness in the child. Or another way of saying it, don't allow your children to be selfish. Again, Mrs. Wesley. Self-will is the root of all sin and misery. So whatever cherishes this in children ensures their after wretchedness and irreligion. Whatever promotes and mortifies it promotes their future happiness and piety. This is still more evident if we consider that religion is nothing more than doing the will of God and not our own. That the one grand impediment to our eternal happiness being this self-will, no indulgences of it can be trivial and no denial unprofitable. Heaven or hell depends on this alone. The parent who studies to subdue it in his child works together with God in the renewing and saving of soul. The parent who indulges it does the devil's work, makes religion impracticable, salvation unattainable, and does all that in him lies to damn his child, soul and body forever. So, Mrs. Wesley says that selfishness is the root of all evil. Thus, you have to attack it early on, relentlessly, until it's finally surrendered. Then number four, submit to punishment. Teach your children to submit to punishment, not to be punished. but to submit to punishment. The difference is enormous. Any adult who's not handicapped, any adult can grab a small child and spank him. But a child has a role in his discipline too. The parent's duty is to inflict the discipline, and the child's duty is to submit to the discipline. Here's what Mrs. Wesley says about it. When a year old, they were taught to fear the rod and to cry softly, by which they escaped abundance of punishment. And that most odious noise of the crying of children was rarely heard in the house. This is something that she has been severely criticized for, crying softly. It seems unreasonable to ask your child to cry softly, but it's not at all, because the pain of discipline is really not all that intense. And so a child may well cry, and probably will cry when being chastised. But a good deal of that crying is not really crying from pain at all. It's crying from frustration and anger and rebellion. She says, let your child cry. Sometimes she's accused of not letting her children cry, but that's a canard. It's simply not true. She lets let her children cry, and she tells us to let our children cry, but not to rebel and be defiant when they're receiving their spankings. So teach your children to submit to punishment. Then number four, this is critically important and an error that many otherwise fine parents make. Do not reward sin. Do not reward sin. Susanna says, they were quickly made to understand they might have nothing they cried for. They were quickly made to understand they might have nothing they cried for. In other words, don't reward your child for throwing a temper tantrum. He asks for a cookie, you say no. He throws a fit, you give him the cookie. What have you just taught him? You've taught him that sin pays rich dividends. Again, I know a mother. Here's what happened. She had three children. She brought these three children to the video store. And the oldest and the youngest child ran wild. They grabbed movies. They insisted that the mom rent these movies for them. The middle child, though, is rather generous by nature. And he said nothing and just perfectly happy to go along with the older and the younger. And so he got nothing. Now, isn't that interesting? Three children go into a video store. Numbers 1 and 3 scream bloody murder and get what they want. Number 2 is generous and easy to get along with, and he gets the inside of a donut. How do you like that? What did she do? Well, she penalized one child for being good and rewarded two other children for being bad. Do not reward sin. Number 5, reward the truth. Reward the truth. Wesley says, it has been observed that fear of punishment often led children into lying till they get a custom of it which they cannot leave. To prevent this, a law was made that whoever was charged with a fault of which they were guilty, if they would honestly confess it and promise to amend, should not be beaten. In other words, don't be so unreasonable and ferocious in your discipline that a child is given an incentive to lie. You see, if your child knows that if he tells the truth or if he lies, either way, he's going to get the same punishment, he's got at least a chance of getting away with it if he lies. By telling the truth, yes, I threw the ball through the window, he knows he's going to get an awful spanking. But by lying, no, I didn't do it, I saw some other kid do it. He knows he has at least a chance of getting away with it. And so when accused of some misbehavior, if a child would honestly fess up to it and promise to amend and show some fruits of repentance, Mrs. Wesley said, I didn't punish them. Reward the truth. Give them an incentive to tell the truth. Number 6, be consistent. Be consistent. Another quote. No sinful action as lying, pilfering, playing at church or on the Lord's Day, disobedience, quarreling, and so forth should ever pass unpunished. Ever. Now you have to remember, Mrs. Wesley had 9 children. And so there were plenty of things to do. You have to also remember that she was very poor and lived in a large house. And so Mrs. Wesley was busy quite literally from the moment she woke up until the moment she collapsed in bed. And yet she said no sinful action ever went unpunished. None that she was aware of was ever let go. She cut her children no slack insofar as that's concerned. The punishment doesn't have to be severe, but it needs to be consistent. A child knows, for example, that every time he lies, every time he acts obnoxiously, every time he fights, he'll suffer the consequences for his evil behavior. Consistency was the hallmark of her discipline. Number 7. And here's another thing that often Christian parents are very lack on. Forgive your child. Forgive your child. Susanna writes, "No child should ever be chided or beaten twice for the same fault. And if they have amended, they should never be upbraided with it afterwards." Forgive your child. When the sin has been committed and has been duly punished, you're to no longer bring it up. You're not to provoke him to wrath in that way. You're not to keep on bringing up the same old sin time and time again with which to torment him. Nor are you to punish him 5 times for one sin. Forgive the child, in other words. Don't hold a grudge yourself. You know if you have more than one child that maybe the ugliest thing you'll ever see is that unforgiving, mean spirit that one child will often manifest to another. Well, sometimes these children come to these attitudes so honestly. They learn the very same things from their parents. So forgive your child. Number 8. Notice your child's good deeds. Some parents watch their children like a hawk when it comes to evil things and seem to be old Bartimaeus when it comes to good things. They can't see a thing. Again, here's what Wesley says. Every act of obedience, especially when it crossed their own inclinations, should be always commended and frequently rewarded according to the merits of the cause. Notice your child's good deeds too. Compliment them, reward them for it. Number 9, compliment good intentions. This is especially applicable to younger children. You see, younger children often are incapable due to either mental immaturity or lack of motor development, little children are sometimes incapable of doing good deeds. But that doesn't mean you wait until they become coordinated or smart enough to reward them. Wesley says compliment good intentions too. If any child performed an act of obedience or did anything with an intention to please, though the performance was not well, yet the obedience and intention should be kindly accepted, and the child with sweetness should be directed how to do better in the future. Your 2-year-old goes out to the garden and picks all of your prize flowers and brings them to you. What do? The flowers that you've babied since they were seeds and cared for like a mother cares for her nursing infant. What do? Well, Mrs. Wesley would have said, "Thank you, dear. That was so kind of you. Mother loves the gift, but please, don't pick flowers in my garden again." Now, is that what you would do? I don't know. Compliment good intentions even when they're not backed up by good actions. Number 10. Demand integrity. Demand integrity. She says, let promises be strictly observed. If your child promises to do something, make him do it. Even if the promise is foolish, if it's not dangerous, I suppose, even if the promise is foolish or produces much discomfort on his part, he must keep his promises. Demand integrity. Remember what the preacher said. He said, if you make a vow to God, defer not to pay it. It is better not to make a vow than to make a vow and not to keep it. So demand integrity. make your children stick to their word. Number 11, stress academic achievement. Up to this point, virtually all of the training has been in the area of morality. Nearly all of the training had reference to character and had no particular reference except indirectly to scholarship. You shouldn't think, though, that Mrs. Wesley was content if her children were just all well-behaved and as dumb as they could be. At that time, you remember, girls did not attend school. Although Mrs. Wesley herself was well-educated by her father, she knew Greek and Latin and French and was an expert in writing the English language. Most girls at that time received nothing beyond what we might call a second or third grade education. Many of them couldn't read at all, and some could read, but only a little bit. So this is the background for her statement. That no girl be taught to work till she can read very well. That she be kept to her work with the same application and for the same time that she was held to in reading. Wanted the child to spend as much time reading or, in general, doing schoolwork as she did work around the home. And that was a great sacrifice on Mrs. Wesley's part because of the largeness of her family and the real number of things that she had to do. Her several girls, I think she had six who survived, her several girls could have done so much around the house, but Mrs. Wesley did not want them to merely be maids and servants. She wanted them to learn how to read, to develop their intellectual capacities, as well as learn how to keep a house. Now, these are the kind of rules that Mrs. Wesley followed, and under the blessing of God, produced her remarkable children. And from them, we find much to condemn in ourselves, don't we? And much to aspire to as well. But the key to Susanna's success was not any one of these rules, or all of them. The key to her success was her state of mind. Here is how she described it. And a better description of motherhood, or really parenthood, I've never read. No one can, without renouncing the world in the most literal sense, observe my method. And there are few, if any, that would entirely devote above 20 years of the prime of life in hopes to save the souls of their children. She's right, isn't it? Not many people are willing to renounce the world, to give up their own pleasures and comforts and ease and time off in order to devote themselves to their children and see that their children be saved. Not very many people are willing to do this, mothers or fathers, either one. Susanna Wesley was, and saw her effort richly rewarded. Now, from this remarkable confession, we find two thoughts which gave direction to Susanna Wesley. First, her appreciation for the issues at stake. Child rearing is, quite literally, a matter of life and death. Heaven and hell, eternal souls hang in the balance. She appreciated what the issues were. The issues were not, will my daughter go to the prom with the star football player, or will she have to go with a second string fellow? She knew better than that. She knew that the issues at stake in rearing children were life and death, heaven and hell, God and Satan. She thought that their eternal destiny lay largely with the way she brought them up. Then number two, her willingness to surrender her own life for the welfare of her children. Now remember, Susanna Wesley was a beautiful woman. She was also extremely intelligent, and she also had almost unlimited energy. So this was not a woman who could do nothing but stay at home and change diapers. This was a truly remarkable woman. But she surrendered the remarkable life that God had given her for the welfare of her children. She lost her life that she might gain theirs. Would you die for your own children? Most parents say yes, but very few would. Yes, you might jump into an icy lake to pull in a drowning baby, but that's not what is usually needed. What they need is you, wholly devoted to their highest good. This means being a good example, practicing a consistent and enlightened discipline, praying for them without ceasing. In other words, it means losing your life to save theirs. Most parents are not willing to really die for their children. Most kill their children that they, the parents, might live. Most kill their children that they, the parents, might live. They forfeit their children's lives in exchange for their own. But this can never be justified. Paul said, "Children, do not lay up for the parents, but parents lay up for the children." In other words, you're not to ask your children to surrender their lives so you can go to Tahiti this summer. You're to give up your own lives so that your children can grow up to be men and women of God. Susanna Wesley survived her evil husband by several years. But in the summer of 1742, the silver cord was loosened. Surrounded by her children, her last audible words were, "Children, as soon as I am released, sing a psalm of praise to God." She died at the age of 74 and was buried in the Bunhill Field Cemetery alongside her spiritual worthies, John Bunyan, John Owen, Isaac Watts, and other great Christians of the past were buried there too. Mrs. Wesley found a suitable resting place. For although she preached no sermon, though she suffered no imprisonment for her faith, and though she didn't win the multitudes to Christ as some of these other men did, Mrs. Wesley fulfilled her ministry as few others have. John Wesley conducted the service and preached with a heavenly utterance. He wrote, "It was one of the most solemn assemblies I ever saw or expect to see on this side of eternity." And Wesley, always meaning business with God and always dealing honestly with souls, rather than eulogizing his mother and spending an hour telling everyone how wonderful she was, he preached on that passage, "And I saw a great white throne of judgment, and books standing before it. And the books were opened, and another book was opened, and those names not found in the Lamb's Book of Life were turned into hell." That's what Wesley preached on at the funeral of his mother. On that day, his mother received a fitting tribute. Though she labored in utter obscurity for so many years and under such hard conditions, she was laid to rest among, as John Wesley put it in his journal, quote, "an almost innumerable company of people." And remember, Wesley was the man who had preached to tens of thousands at a time, and never had he seen a larger congregation than those gathered to bid his dear mother adieu. What a tribute to female godliness. On that day, the world rose to its feet and called her blessed. But better than that, the King of Glory stood and welcomed her, no doubt with these words, "Well done, you good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord." So she did, and so I can wish the same for all of us. Amen.